And this evening, as we get into your word, Father, as usual, we ask for your blessing upon our time. Thank you that we can gather. And thank you for this study in the book of Deuteronomy. There are some head-scratching things for us, and we'll see some of those things tonight. And I understand this to be the case. This has to be the case. It made far more sense for your people thousands of years ago, hearing these laws, hearing these regulations, hearing these outlines for what you designed your people, the Jewish people, how they were to function. So whatever application we might pull from this study and these studies in Deuteronomy, we would ask for your blessing upon it. Give us understanding. Give us grace for these things. And may your word, by your Holy Spirit, fashion our hearts to long for you. And even with the question marks that arise from the study of your word, would those question marks kind of spur us on, encourage us to further study, to dig deeper? Have greater desire, fuller hunger for the things of you. So thank you that we can gather. Thank you that you hear our prayers in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so we are in chapter 22. Chapter 22, we went all the way through verse 12 of chapter 22 last week, so pick it up in verse 13 and some basic principles here. It says, if any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, I took this woman, and when I came to her I found she was not a virgin, then the father and mother of the young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. And of course, that's where the elders would meet. That's where they'd gather. That's where you'd go for a ruling. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he detests her. And now he has charged her with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin. And yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity. So this is the conversation they would have with the elders. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. And then the elders of that city shall take the man and punish him, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel, and she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. And then verse 21, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house. Verse 20, but if the thing is true and evidence of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel to play the harlot in her father's house, and so you shall put away the evil from among you. I'll tell you, I've read handfuls of devotional books over the years. I've not found this passage in any of the daily devotional types of books, but here it is. And you know, even as I was praying, of course, you know, we're praying together, this made a lot more sense in that day. We look at it and scratch our heads and go, what on earth is this? They would have got it, you know, yep, okay, yep, that makes sense. Yes, this makes perfect sense. We're not part of that culture, and we're not of the house of Israel. So as Gentiles, it makes even less sense for us, but nonetheless, this is what it was for them. So again, some basic principles from this. First of all, this should be fairly obvious. Virginity, especially in the Israeli, the Jewish, the Hebrew culture, was greatly valued, to put a weak point on that. Highly valued, almost beyond measure. And as it should be valued in any society. Virginity before marriage, it's how it should be. It's such a shame. And there's so many issues kind of born from this. I mean, like Jeremiah and I were just having, he's like, wait, what were we talking about? Like just before service, you know, minimum wage issues and children born out of wedlock and all these different types of things, where our society here in the United States of America, our great Judeo-Christian, whatever that is anymore, our society mocks that concept, that of virginity and abstinence, mocks that concept to its own hurt, to the hurt of our own society. So again, some basic principles here in the text. If a woman lost or gave up her virginity in that culture, of course, and so many cultures today, this is still true, it would be tougher for her to find a husband or to have a husband found for her. It was a dishonor, and obviously, as it's being stated here, it's dishonor upon the whole family. So if the new husband, if her husband, believed she had lied about that, lied about her virginity, he'd be hurt, as you'd expect, if there's these claims. And, of course, this is vice versa. The custom of the parents bringing some kind of proof of her virginity. Okay, like what is that, that they're gonna lay this before the elders? This would have been a cloth for her first night, and this was accepted as evidence. Though, as one old commentator noted, this is, and I quote, a roughness of manners which would ill comport with the refinement of European ideas on so delicate a subject, end quote. As in our Western culture, like, we don't like to talk about this stuff. And this was the concept, though. And however this would have worked, it would have worked. So if this man detests her and says she's definitely not a virgin, if he's wrong, he's wrong for the rest of his life in that marriage. You read that, right? He cannot divorce her all his days there in verse 19. And I read that, and you know the first thing that comes to mind for me, especially as a dad of three girls, I think, well, that stinks for her. This is my, she's terrible, I detest her, and this is a public thing. She's definitely lying about her virginity. Like, well, actually, she's not. Sorry, babe. Like, how does that go for the rest of her life? Unless he tries to make it up to her for the rest of his life and her life. And of course, if he was right, though, and you read the same thing I read, this is death in that society. And you saw what I saw, that this is to, in order to put away, at the end of verse 22, put away the evil from Israel. And how many times have we read that just the last week or two? You know, there's the drunken son that doesn't listen to anything, and these other issues, like to put away the evil from it. Well, anyone can do whatever they want. Cool. There's consequences. And we talked about this on Sunday, that this civil disobedience and biblical civil disobedience of Daniel and his three friends, cool, you're welcome to do, but there are consequences to doing whatever you want. And in that culture, in the culture of the people of God, the Jewish people, they were to put away the evil. And it's interesting that it's called that, this disgraceful thing at the end of verse 21, to play the harlot in her father's house. So Moses, delivering these instructions to the people, this next generation, continues, verse 22. If a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die. The man that lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall put away the evil from Israel. So what's being described here? This is a penalty for adultery. Continue, verse 23, if a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, so this is her fiance, she's engaged, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones, the young woman because she did not cry out in the city, and the man because he humbled his neighbor's wife. And so an engaged woman was considered, you know, betrothed was considered to be that, the wife. And you shall put away the evil from among you. Okay, so these penalties for adultery, obviously, again, per the last section of this chapter, there's social consequences for certain things. And this is wrong for both the man and the woman. Notice this, caught in adultery. Though one commentator pointed this out as I was studying this, you know, a week ago, the death penalty for this, for adultery, was likely very rare, likely practiced very rare. Why? Remember chapter 17? What was the requirement for the death penalty? Two or three witnesses. So for the case of adultery, this, you wouldn't see this. That's the whole concept, right? Interesting, though, as it would be death for both of them. I don't know if your New Testament brains are kind of going on overload, but perhaps you're thinking about John chapter 8 and the woman caught in the very act of adultery. I mean, here's your commentary for that. Where was the dude? Like, both of them. It's just her, and obviously it was a whole ploy, and that's a whole other conversation itself. But essentially what we're learning from the Lord's plan for His people, there are to be standards in society. Society such as ours here in the United States of America, again, disregard such standards at our own peril. We disregard such standards and such ideals at the expense of society itself. Well, anyone can do what they want to do. Sure they can. Fine. But there are consequences to this. Now concerning rape, verse 25, but if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die, as should be the case. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin deserving of death. For just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is this matter. In other words, she's the victim and purely that. Verse 27, for he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed woman, young woman, cried out, but there was no one to save her. If a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, and he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has humbled her. He shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. And good luck understanding that in so many... get some commentaries for some of this, for sure. In terms of the rape here, again, the woman was not blamed for this. If it's determined that it's not rape, there's other consequences. If they're not engaged, the concept, as far as I understand this, that they would get married. So if they were engaged, it's the equivalent, or if she was engaged, it's the equivalent of adultery. By the way, did you notice kind of in this section and the last section, the concept, the side note to this, but there was no one to help her, or she cried out, or she did not cry out. I mean, imagine this in that day. Even cities would have been so much quieter. You know what you didn't have? The noise of cars. I mean, like right here in downtown Rogers. Oh my gosh, like at our house, right there. The airport is, what, maybe a mile away? Maybe. Just the sound of downtown, the sound at 2 o'clock in the morning. Trucks in front of Tyson, like they're just laying on their horn, like what are you doing at 2 o'clock in the morning? The train, you ever like just having a cup of coffee downtown when the train goes by and boom, just lays on the horn? The factory, you know, just the sounds of the cities. But then with no factories, no machines, no trains, no cars, etc., nice and quiet. You'd hear someone screaming, someone crying for help. You would hear that. So kind of the side note to the side note there in the text, what were we to do if someone's crying for help? We're to help them. Like, this is how the Lord would expect anyone. And it might cost you something. No matter, you still help. And I would think even in like kind, as God's people cried out to Him from Egypt, He helped them. He would expect His people to help. Interesting stuff here. Notice verse 30 further. A man shall not take his father's wife nor uncover his father's bed. This is likely, you know, a son marrying his stepmother after his dad has died. Why that's in there? Well, it's in there so they would know not to do that, I suppose. And the New Testament, of course, you have 1 Corinthians chapter 5, right? Verses 1 and 2, where even the Gentiles don't do stuff like that. So, hey, people of Israel, you're not to do that either. We get to chapter 23, there's various exclusions from the company of Israel in one way or another. Verse 1, he was emasculated by crushing or mutilation. Aren't you glad you came on a Wednesday night? Shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. One of illegitimate birth shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord. An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Why? Verse 4. Because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. Nevertheless, verse 5, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. You shall not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever. You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you are an alien in his land. And verse 8, the children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. Again, this would have made far more sense to them and that original audience hearing this. Now, there's some various opinions on this. As it says, they shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. And that's repeated a couple times. The opinions would be basically this: excluded from what exactly? Is it describing like you're kicked out of the nation of Israel altogether, perhaps? Is it simply talking about you're removed, excluded from the religious life, from worship, perhaps? So you're still part of Israel, though you can't really worship, however that would have worked for them. Some people think that it's simply referencing any kind of leadership at all. If you were wanted to be a leader of one of the tribes, like a governmental type of a assembly, like you'd not be able to do so. For you note takers, if you want to dig into this further, Isaiah 56 makes it clear that eunuchs and foreigners would be welcomed, would be accepted before the Lord if they'd submit to him. This is Isaiah 56 verses 3 to 5, if you want to dig into that and come to your own conclusion about what might be happening there. Verse 9 continues, when the army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. Oh man, this, we'll get to that when we get to the book of Joshua for sure. Verse 10, if there is any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp, but it shall be when evening comes and he shall wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. Also, verse 12, you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. Have a little shovel that you have with you, essentially. This is fascinating to me. Why? I would think, obviously, keep things clean and sanitary. Fine, yes, why? Verse 14, for, or because, the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp. There's no facilities. You need to use the facilities. Go outside the camp. You don't just do that in the middle of the camp. Why? God walks in the midst of you. It's interesting that it's phrased that way. He walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. Interesting. Other various laws and restrictions for the Jewish people included verse 15. You shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his master to you. He's running away from his master. There's probably a reason for it. Like, don't send him back. He may dwell with you in your midst in the place which he chooses within one of your gates where it seems best to him. You shall not oppress him. Now, that's different than most any culture. Verse 17, there shall be found no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one. And a perverted one, the Hebrew can literally be translated, one practicing sodomy and prostitution in religious rituals, not to be found among you. Verse 18, you shall not bring the wages of a harlot or the price of a dog to the house of the Lord your God for any vowed offering. Like, I need to give the Lord something. find a different way to find some money to bring to the Lord. For both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. Verse 19 says, you shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest. To a foreigner, verse 20, you may charge interest, but to your brother you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all to which you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. If you're a note taker, you might jot down Psalm 15 for this. I'm just going to read it to you. Psalm 15. It's a Psalm of David, and he asks, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? And then he answers it in verses 2, 3, 4, and 5. He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart, he who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. And then Psalm 15 and verse 5, he who does not put out his money at usury or at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent, he who does these things shall never be moved. The concept there, back here in Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20, verses 19 and 20, is this basic principle, which would be in a word, what? Love. If you have the means, the money or whatever, to help someone else that's in a position of hardship, that's why they're asking you for the loan in the first place. You can accommodate it because it's not a cost really to you. You just have it. You've got money laying around that, I'm not using it for anything. And they clearly need this, and there'll be some other instances of this conversation in the next couple chapters. But another person's hardship is not an opportunity for you to make some extra cash with the money that you have when you could already, you don't even need it, you're not using it for anything. They clearly need help. You're in a position to afford to be able to give out the loan. It's not hurting you whatsoever. It's not an opportunity like, man, this person's really hating it right now. They're going through a tough time. Sweet. And it's not sweet. It's what can I do to help them instead? Again, the basic principle, love. Help others. Verse 21, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it. Lord, I promise I will. Fill in the blank. Do it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be sin to you if you don't. But if you abstain from vowing, it shall not be sin to you. Lord, I promise. Nope. Lord, I really would like to. I really hope to. Fill in the blank, whatever that thing might be. And that which has gone from your lips, you shall keep and perform, for you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. And when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes at your pleasure, but you shall not put any in your container. Like that. Verse 25, when you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. In other words, verse 24 and 25, hey neighbor, what's your chit-chatting maybe with your neighbor? How's it going? And just chatting, you know, maybe eating some grapes there or whatever. And like, yeah, good talking to you. And you reach into your bag and pull out some kind of container, just load up your container. Okay, see you later. Like, those aren't your grapes. If there's just a couple while you're there, fine. You just happen to be over there, fine. But, yeah, I got my sickle here real quick just while we're talking, and let me just get some grain here. Like, I don't know. I don't know what the Hebrew would be for don't be cheap, but maybe... Don't be that way towards your neighbor, I would think, the basic concept there. Chapter 24, little bit to unpack in verses 1 through 4. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house, and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter's husband, like it's already getting confusing, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then the former husband, i.e. the first guy, verse 4, who divorced her, must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. I should say, as a little bit of a side note, I think that the Protestant church, and rightly so, you know, we find instances where certain things are an abomination to the Lord, and we tend to camp out on certain of those things. But if we want to be, and we've studied these things in his word, if you want to be an equal opportunity Bible believer, treat them all the same way. Abominations and abominations. So the little bit to unpack here, let's start with this. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 1 provides some commentary on this. And the land, Jeremiah discusses, by way of people marrying, divorcing, remarrying, etc., a whole bunch of back and forths with people, says the land would be greatly polluted. And I would imagine greatly confusing. And gratefully, the Lord gives some guidelines to this, because not only would it be confusing, I would think this would also be greatly to the benefit of people who just want to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do whatever they want to do. I'm like, okay, what are we talking about? In other words, there's always going to be people who try to find some loophole to legally, and there's no nice way to say this, to legally, well, I signed a certificate of divorce, was unhappy with her, put it in her hand, we're divorced, I sent her out of my house. So they want to find a loophole to legally, no nice way to say it, sleep around. Actually, of course, to be promiscuous is the nice way to say it, but of course, in this instance here, it's less about promiscuity, it's about the multiplying of adultery, really. So what that does, when people just gave the certificate of divorce for whatever, it highlighted the heart of the issue, sinful hearts, people want to do whatever they want to do, and it highlights the importance and the necessity of the law. And what's the point of God's law? I mean, this is the big question in all of it. What's the point of the Bible? What's the point of God's law? What's the point of rules and regulations from on high? I know I've discussed this before. Is it just because God's like, I'm super bored, and everyone's just having a good time, and I don't want mankind to have a good time, so I think I'm just, I don't know, off the top of my head, just assign some dumb rules just to kind of ruin their lives? That's not how God functions. He gives us rules and regulations for what? For one thing. Well, it's more than one thing, but the main thing would be to keep us safe. And therefore, when we're safe, it keeps us happy. Well, I don't understand those rules. Sorry. Sometimes he explains the point of these rules. Other times, don't eat bats. Why not? Because I said so, and he's God, and you know, fast forward thousands of years, and we go, oh, actually, because it's really not good for you. For them, it was just a matter of faith. I don't know, that bat looks really, I don't know if anyone, they're like, man, that bat looks really tasty. Shades of Ozzy Osbourne here. Like, and eat a bat, but because I'm saying I don't want you to do that, and he doesn't have to explain himself. And we all understand this. If you have kids, if you have grandkids, if you have like little nieces or nephews, and that you're supposed to be watching them, well, you're not allowed to play in the street. Well, there's the most space there. You're not allowed to do it. Well, why not? I want to play in the street. Well, because you're going to get hurt. We're trying to keep you safe. You'd be more blessed over here in the yard. That's the point of this. Well, I'd like to have some ice cream 5 minutes. Actually, that sounds great. I always want ice cream 5 minutes before dinner. But like, you're going to spoil your appetite. Well, I still, whether they understand it or not, rules are given for our safety, our blessing, and our benefit. So the rules that the Lord assigns to his people, they're for the good of his people. Perhaps as we read this, again, there's a few things to unpack here. Perhaps your New Testament mind latched onto this wording, the certificate of divorce. And maybe in your mind, actually you're welcome to put a bookmark here for a second and turn over the Gospel of Mark, because Jesus talks about this. The Gospel of Mark chapter 10. Just read verses 1 through 12. Then he, Jesus, arose from there and came to the region of Judea by the other side of the Jordan, and multitudes gathered to him again. And as he was accustomed, he taught them again. And the Pharisees came and asked him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" Testing him. That's important there in Mark chapter 10 and verse 2. And in verse 3, he answered and said to them, "What did Moses command you?" And they said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and to dismiss her." Here's Jesus' opinion on what we're studying back here in Deuteronomy. Jesus answered and said to them, "Because of the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this precept." That's why it's there. Oh. But, here's a contrast, verse 6, "But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female, and for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh." Therefore, in his commentary on the book of Genesis now, interesting, what does Jesus do? He teaches. They ask a question. He answers with a question. He gives them Bible. He explains the point of it, the heart issue behind it, and then he provides the example from Scripture all the way back to the beginning of Genesis. And then verse 9 is his commentary. "Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." End of discussion. However, verse 10, in the house, this would probably be, you know, later on, whatever. In the house, his disciples also asked him again about this same matter. So like, "Jesus, what do we need to know about this?" And he said to them, verse 11, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." So I'll add some other commentary, because there's obviously some discussion to this. But for this part of the conversation, what he explains there, it's enough. It's enough for that aspect of the conversation. Again, he provides the word. He explains that, you know, what we're studying here back in Deuteronomy chapter 24, this permit or this certificate of divorce was permitted because of the hardness of heart. What is left to be discussed back here in Deuteronomy 24 is what Moses and what the Lord himself meant by some uncleanness. "I detest her because there's some uncleanness." Of course, old Jewish rabbis, it was anything that made the man unhappy. And you probably heard teaching on this, and like, that really literally would include, if she burned his meal, then I'm unhappy with her and here's her certificate of divorce. Let's just say it. Obviously, this is not the will of God, based on Jesus' commentary, based on what Jeremiah chapter 3 mentions, and the reference from Jesus all the way back to Genesis. Plus, I think we can just kind of, as a wide, broad brush sweeping statement, and oh, by the way, like, the Bible, right? Like, that's just not how it works. The uncleanness that's mentioned there in Deuteronomy 24, we kind of have to look at this. It doesn't seem to be adultery. Why? Because under the law, what? She'd be put to death. So it has to be something else. Having said that, Jesus' New Testament application for this for his followers, we read this in Mark chapter 10, but Jesus actually talked about this, and the parallel passage would be over in Matthew chapter 19. If you're a note taker, and again, you want to dig into this, this is Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. "Whoever divorces his wife," and then he makes it clear, Matthew gives us a little more detail, "whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery." So it would seem that adultery would be kind of the main, I don't know if this is the right word, default for permissible certificate of divorce. At the same time, I think there's, you know, a number of ways to break your vows. You know, you hear about this so much, and I think there's been a lot of real bad teaching in the church over the years that, you know, if there's a man that's abusing his wife, well, she has to stay with him. I just don't think that that's the case. I think he's clearly breaking his vows. He has vowed to love her, to take care of her, to cherish her. Instead of doing that, he's breaking his promise and he's physically hurting her or whatever else is happening. I think there's plenty of room there that he's broken his vows. It's time for her to leave. I would think it's pretty poor counsel to say you have to stay with him no matter what. All that to say, and again, this is just our through the Bible, so we're not going to get into all the nitty-gritty of all of these types of things, but all of this would seem to me to be simply this. God takes this all very seriously and would like very much for us to join him in taking marriage and sexuality, for that matter as well, seriously. So the basic concept back here in Deuteronomy 24, especially when you read it, so a man finds no favor in his wife, is unhappy with her, some uncleanness, certificate of divorce, and that's what it would be. He writes her a certificate of divorce, piece of paper, puts it in her hand, sends her away. We're done here. I signed it myself. She goes and marries someone else. Either he finds unhappiness or signs his own certificate. Like, there's no legal process. There's no notary public. Nothing, right? It's just this is what's happening. You can imagine that what would happen, especially in that kind of male-dominated culture, where men were clearly abusing their role as to take care of other human beings, that it would be a great excuse for a man to say, well, actually, I think I'd find more happiness in this woman, so I'm married to her, so I'll write a certificate of divorce, and would you marry me? And then what are we describing here? There's a whole lot of back and forth happening with a lot of men and women. And again, what happens in society, that gets terribly confusing. This happens in modern culture, and more, again, as we push away the revealed word of God, it's kids that suffer the most and households that suffer the most and kids that aren't sure who do I call mom and who do I call dad and this other. It gets really messy really quickly. The Lord has a plan. He would expect us to stick to it. And he understands that there's other issues that would mean that vow becomes broken. Verse 5. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year. Like, that's how much time do you get off from work? A year. And bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. And it's interesting that it says it that way, because I wonder how many women would be like, I'm fine for like a month. Go back to work, sweetheart. I don't know. But notice this is actually repetition from chapter 20 and verse 7. But this adds a little bit more detail and more clarity. Take a year off and then get back to work. Verse 6, no man shall take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. Hey, can I borrow some money? Yeah, but I need like a down payment, that kind of thing. And I got my mill here, the stones that would crush the grain and that kind of thing. Like, okay, well, give me the upper millstone. Well, I can't really. Give me the lower one. In other words, what's the problem? He can no longer crush grain, so he's trying to sell grain to be able to make a living to pay back this loan that he had. It's, I'll pay you back, but he needs the tools to be able to do so. So it's one of those, like, again, be sensible, be loving in this thing. Verse 7, if a man is found kidnapping any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and he mistreats or sells him, then the kidnapper shall die. And you shall, it's like almost say it with me, you shall put away the evil from among you. I don't know if any of your translations render it this way, but literally this can be translated steals. If he steals another human being, that's the concept. Like, no, there's a death penalty for that. Verse 8, take heed in an outbreak of leprosy, pay attention, that you carefully observe and do according to all the priests, the Levites shall teach you, just as I commanded them, so you shall be careful to do. Is there an outbreak of leprosy? Pay attention to those who are in charge. They're going to help you so you don't get sick. Remember, verse 9, what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way when you came out of Egypt. And the New King James has an exclamation point at the end of that. Remember Miriam. So remember all those details. We talked about all the details about leprosy. You can go back and read those at your leisure. Verse 10, when you lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to get his pledge. Just verse 11, stand outside, and the man to whom you lend shall bring the pledge out. I'm going to go get it right now. Just come on. Just be considerate, be loving, show some love here. Verse 12, and if the man is poor, you shall not keep his pledge overnight. You shall in any case return the pledge to him again when the sun goes down, that he may sleep in his own garment and bless you. And it shall be righteousness to you before the Lord your God. Further, verse 14, you shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in the land within your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages and not let the sun go down on it, for he is poor and his heart is set on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord and it be sin to you. Again, this is considerate. It's all I have is my garment. Can I just, I promise to pay you back. Here's the, you know, my show of faith that I'm gonna do this, and you keep it, give it back to them. Well, it's gonna cost me. I'm gonna have to go back to his house every night. And it, yeah, actually, this again would speak of love, because love seeks to do for others. Verse 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. We talked about this on Sunday, didn't we? With Daniel and the lions, and all those people got thrown in. That was the king of Medo-Persia. That was his decision, Gentile decision. By the way, if you're a note taker, again, this is directly referenced. Verse 16 is directly referenced in 2 Kings chapter 14. If you want to dig into that, as Amaziah the king put to death those who had murdered his father, but he refused to put to death their children. And then he actually quotes this directly. And it's not, or that with Amaziah there in 2 Kings 14, it wasn't a show of mercy. Like, really? Really? It wasn't about him showing mercy. It was purely a demonstration of obedience to God's word. He might have liked it, like, I'm so merciful. He is just doing what the Bible says. Oh, verse 17. You shall not pervert justice due the stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment as a pledge, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. You know, I'll tell you, I know I've talked about this before because we've seen it in, you know, this section of Scripture. It's not simply do as I say. And as I said just a little bit ago, he's God, so he can actually just say, do what I say. And we're supposed to listen because he's actually an all-knowing and perfectly loving God. So he wants what's best for us. But sometimes he does include things like, paraphrase here, do as I do. I'd like you to behave this way. Why? Well, because I behaved this way when you were a slave in Egypt. I showed mercy. I sought to redeem you. I sought to bless you. I sought to bring you out. I sought to bring you shelter. I sought to bring you into a good land. Hey, people who are delivered, be like your God. Not just because he says so, but he did so. He demonstrated this. That's Old Testament. I should think for us as Christians, I mean, you guys understand what that word is, right? You know that in the early days of the early church in the book of Acts, when someone was called a Christian, I believe it was in Antioch when they were first called Christians, it means little Christs. It was an insult. You guys are just trying to be like that Christ fella. You're trying to be like that Jesus. You're just like little Christ. It's like, oh, it's showing. Yay, it's working. We're doing something right that publicly people recognize that we're trying to be followers of Jesus, like trying to be like Jesus. Well, actually, we are. I think we can take that as a great compliment. And so as a follower of Jesus, yeah, let's go out of our way to take care of, to love other people. Verse 19, when you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Notice that kind of theme throughout this too. It's good for you when you do these types of things. verse 20, when you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. We talked about this back in Leviticus 19. You can go back and study that, listen to that if you want. But leave the scraps. Scraps is probably not the right word, because it wasn't just like the worthless stuff. It was just the stuff that you didn't quite gather. It's almost the leftovers. In other words, he's saying, look, you don't need to collect every last grape. Just leave it. It's fine. And it would be for others to come along and collect for themselves. This would be an absolutely fantastic welfare system. They have to get up. They've got to do something. You've helped them by leaving it for them. It's whoever wants it, come and get it. It's your stuff, so you think, I have every right for every olive, every grape, everything. I left the sheaf back there. Leave it. That bundle, just leave it. Yeah, but it's mine. Leave it. And the blessing to you is like, God, you've provided enough for me, so I'm trusting that I'll be fine. And I'm trusting that I'll also be fine by being a blessing to others. Isn't that amazing how that works? Like when we're a blessing to others around us, others are profited, society, our community, our church, everything. Like, no longer is there all these extra burdens if everyone's just doing what we can to help one another. It's interesting how the Lord has this whole thing planned for the benefit of everybody involved. I don't know. I've got chapter 25. How's everybody doing? Wednesday night people, you all right? All right. The first time I see someone fall asleep, and if there is a dispute between men and they come to court, that the judges may judge them, and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence, according to his guilt, with a certain number of blows. 40 blows he may give him, and no more, lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, kind of these stripes laid upon their backs, and your brother be humiliated in your sight. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 24, Paul the Apostle, 2 Corinthians 11, 24, talked about, he said, from the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. Concept here in Deuteronomy 25, verses 1 through 3, is that this is all going to happen in front of the judge. Everything's kind of noteworthy. Everything's on the up and up. So it's not like what's happening as soon as that man leaves, and if there's some angry guards or something, they're going to abuse this guy. And I think Rome actually adopted this too. You can probably dig into this if you want to look into some Roman history. But the minus one stripe that Paul referenced in 2 Corinthians 11, as I understand this, would be that of mercy. So if it calls for 40, let it be 40. That's justice. And as he said there, anything beyond that would be humiliation, which is now outside of the bounds of true justice. That's not justice to humiliate someone as they're receiving what's due them. So the minus one, the mercy kind of thing, would be you deserve 40, we're giving you 39, that's some level of mercy, but it would also ensure that justice happens. Why? Well, what if someone miscounts and you actually get to 41? That's actually beyond justice. It's more than was required. It's not just beyond justice. We'd call that unjust. So they would count 39 just in case someone miscounted. If it happened to only be 39 and not 40, well, then good for that person. But they wanted to make sure that it was in that bounds. And again, the humiliation part, that's neither in keeping with justice nor righteousness. He goes on in verse 4 and says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Now, we talked about this back in our time in chapter 14 several weeks ago. So if you missed that study, you can go back and listen to that. And when we were talking about that in chapter 14 several weeks ago, I just mentioned, yep, we're going to see this in chapter 25. It's like, We traveled in time, and here we are. But in terms of taking care of church leaders, Paul actually quotes Deuteronomy 25 and verse 4 twice. He quotes this in 1 Corinthians 9 and 1 Timothy chapter 5. So you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. So there's some New Testament application, and Jesus kind of referenced that sort of thing there too, but there's some New Testament application towards taking care of leaders. The immediate application here in Deuteronomy 25 and verse 4 from an animal standpoint, like, just take care of your animals. It's working hard to get food for you. Well, give it a snack while it's treading out the grain. It's not going to eat your whole crop. Just let it have whatever it needs. Like the welfare kind of system, there's grapes on the ground. Take care of your ox too. This is a Proverbs 12 verse 10 kind of thing in my mind. Proverbs 12:10. A righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. We've all seen those videos and the music that accompanies those videos, always in a minor key, and like, oh my goodness, that dog's being chained up and no one's taking care. And there's a person that's just not taking care. And it's heartbreaking. And the Lord would say, Proverbs 12:10, a righteous man regards the life of his animal. Like, take care of your animals. You got an animal? Take care of your animal. It's interesting. He apparently cares about life. From here, Moses moves to taking care of your extended family. Verse 5, if brothers, dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother, i.e. her brother-in-law, shall go in to her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her, which would be verse 6, and it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that, or so that, this is the point, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So this would be for the preservation of the family line or the dead brother's family name. I want to maintain that family line. Yeah, it's interesting how family names can disappear in a generation. I know, like, this from my mom's side of the family. Her maiden name is Sullivan. And she is the second of seven kids. Three of those kids are girls, so they would have taken, you know, their husband's last name. So that would have left four Sullivan men. And of those four Sullivan men, none of them have had, or by blood, none of them have had children bearing the name Sullivan. Like, just like that, in a generation, the name's gone. It's fascinating. Other than my cousin Bren, he's my Korean cousin who's adopted, and my Irish cousin, Korean cousin Bren, is the only, like, Sullivan male that's having kids in terms of blood. It's interesting, but they want to make sure that the name and the heritage would remain. However, verse 7, but if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, I'm not willing to do that, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother, you know, to give me a son to honor my deceased husband. And then the elders of his city shall call and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, yep, it's here in the Bible, and answer and say, so it shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. Like, you're refusing to take care of your brother's lineage. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed. And you're like, okay, whatever that means. But you know, in that Middle Eastern culture, like, you take off a shoe and throw it at the President of the United States or whatever, like, take off your shoe, like, that is the worst insult imaginable. We're like, really? Really? Like, you, why would you not want, your brother died? This is your sister-in-law? What does she have left now? Well, maybe she'll remarry, hopefully. And that's it for your brother's family? Yeah, that's too bad. I just don't want to do that. Well, you're this shoeless guy here, whatever. By the way, for you students of the Bible, you might be thinking of the book of Ruth, and you might be thinking of Ruth chapter 4, Ruth and Boaz and him being the kinsman redeemer, but there was one kinsman that was closer to Boaz, and he said, no thanks, I'll take a pass on that. And the sandal was removed for that guy and everything there in Ruth chapter 4. I think that's a good stopping point, and you can keep reading on your own, keep reading the book of Deuteronomy, and we'll pretty much start with some of the same things next week that we started this week. Pick it up in verse 11 next week. Bless you. Thanks for coming. See you on Sunday.